Nothing's certain in politics, but professionals know one thing. Subscribing to the Cook Political Report is the right decision in every election cycle.
For more than four decades, the Cook Political Report has been providing political professionals with the right analysis to help them invest political capital with confidence.
A deep knowledge of the past, combined with a meticulous, unbiased analysis of the present, produces the most accurate predictions of the future, time and time again.
Because it's all backed by data from every input that decides elections for president, Congress, and governorships.
Subscribers to the Cook Political Report get the clarity they need through smart analysis that you won't get anywhere else.
Like the very latest outlook for every race and access to our analysts. Amy Walter, David Wasserman, Carrie Dan, Jessica Taylor, Aaron Covey, and Matthew Klein.
The Cook Political Report offers
the right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
The right analysis.
For getting it right.
Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe.
Hello and welcome to The Odd Years. I'm Amy Walter. Well, it took us a minute, but we're back with our first episode of this midterm year. And when political news and events are breaking faster than the human brain can process, I find it important to step back, take a deep breath, and talk to people with experience, insight, and perspective to help me make sense of it all. Which is why I kicked off the inaugural 2026 episode with two political reporters who embody those traits. The Wall Street Journal's Annie Linsky and Puck's Peter Hamby. Now, I've known these two for years and have always been impressed not just by their smarts and scoops, but by their level-headedness and ability to separate the buzzy from the newsworthy. In this episode, Annie gives us some important insights into Trump's rare backtrack on immigration enforcement in Minnesota. Peter's been doing a lot of great reporting and survey research on young voters and gives us a timely update on their views of Trump and how they view the potential 2028 Democratic presidential candidates. We also talk what we should make of Trump's talk of quote-unquote nationalizing elections and whether the Republicans' proposed voter ID law could actually make it harder for their own supporters to cast a ballot. We recorded this conversation on February 10th. Hey, Peter. Hey, Annie. Thanks for joining me.
Good to be here.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Really, really happy to have you here to help us decipher what in the heck is going on in politics. And I'm gonna start, gonna pull back 30,000 foot here. We're a little over a year into Trump 2.0. And as you guys know, he started the year flying pretty high, winning an election, obviously, but also with the popular vote. He was signing executive orders at a breakneck pace. He was bending institutions like law firms and academic institutions to his will. Now here we are, February of 2026, he's at his lowest approval rating of his second term. In fact, I think he's almost at or a little bit lower than where he was at this point in his first term. So, Annie, I'm gonna start with you. What happened?
The president certainly has had a rocky start to this year. Although, I mean, even to your point, I think coming out of December and his Venezuela action, he felt quite good. And that, I guess, you know, technically was in January, but a lot of January became very turbulent for him. You know, he had a month where he, you know, was going into to Davos to meet with the Europeans, and that was supposed to be somewhat of a triumphal event for him, where he, you know, there was rumors that he was going to announce his Fed chair, he was going to talk about housing, but he was going into Davos sort of being able to show that he had brought this kind of internationalist moneyed class to his will.
Mm-hmm.
But then the whole conversation in Davos was all about Greenland and his threats to sort of implicit threats to use United States military to take over a territory owned, controlled by a NATO ally, which would have split apart that very European alliance that's been so strong. And all of those members of that European alliance were kind of descending on Davos at the same time. And that became one of the kind of rare instances where Trump, you know, found an off-ramp. And, you know, you've seen him do that in a few instances. But with Greenland, he looked for an off-ramp and it sort of appears that he found one. But then he sort of had a number of other issues, I mean, domestically, and we can talk about this at greater length, Minnesota and the ICE tactics there,
that's right,
I think were devastating for him. And then you saw him again really change on one of his key things, which is immigration, and change tactics on one of his, like, you know, most important issues, which is unusual for him.
It is. And Peter, that's, I kind of want to get at, you know, the sort of swaggering that the administration came into this 2025-26 with, which is, we expanded this coalition, we are now the multiracial populist party, we've got Democrats on the back foot. They spent most of 2025 in this whole, like, Eeyore, right? Like, oh, we're so bad. We're never going to win. We've lost our way. And now the president seems to be exactly where he's always been with many of these voters, which is underwater, especially with those new voters he brought into the process. So was this sort of a gradual thing, Peter, or is it that he's made choices that have really pushed away the very people he brought into his coalition in the first place?
I think he's made choices that actually led to this coalition sinking pretty quickly and not gradually. Stepping back for a second, I think one of the dominant traits of the Trump administration and Trump people in the White House is cockiness. They came in claiming a mandate, like you said. It reminds me of the Patriots making the Super Bowl. Their fans kicked back into cocky gear, as they always do, but they had the weakest schedule in 20 years. You know, you got to be a little humble. And Donald Trump didn't really beat a great candidate or two candidates, if you include Biden. And so they came in pretty cocky. And the Greenland example is a good one. They started doing things that people didn't ask for. And so getting to your question, Amy, about how this happened, I think they came in promising to lower costs, fix the border, which they have done, more or less, in a rather aggressive way, but and also end the wars. Okay, so if you think about those were the three pillars that Donald Trump ran on, he claims to have ended 8 or 9 wars, but I don't think most Americans are thinking about Congo and Rwanda and Azerbaijan. He hasn't fixed Ukraine and Russia. Israel is a ceasefire. And the most important thing is costs. Energy costs are going up. The rate of inflation is bumpy. Food prices are still high. You know, they like to point to gas prices, but there's many, many places where people aren't feeling it. And so there are two poll numbers that I wanted to point out. And this is me falling back on what I've sort of made into a beat, which is the young men beat. But I think it reveals a lot about how voters think. So we did a poll at PUC with Generation Lab, which surveys college students, which is not young people as a whole. Only about 30% of people actually go to college, but it's a good sample here. And this is among young people, not just young men. But we asked college kids to describe, quote, the impact of Trump's presidency on the country so far. 62% of students, college students, said Trump is making things worse. 8% said Trump is making things better. That's terrible. Okay, so here's the other thing that I picked up from John Della Volpe, who's doing this Democratic research project called Speaking with American Men. Super big, high quality poll that he gave me the insights into a couple months ago. And this is among young men. 27% of young men agreed that Donald Trump is delivering for people like you. But 40% said he talked big but let people like me down. 26% said he's made an effort but he didn't deliver. So Donald Trump won young men, again, just one subgroup out of many, but part of his coalition. And, you know, it was on those promises I mentioned, costs, ending the wars, and the border. And very quickly, if you go back, his support really collapsed right around Liberation Day and right before with this group. Around tariffs, because it just felt like he was actually doing the opposite thing. He was, you know, making costs higher for people. And then, you know, I think the larger coalition really started to wither once these ICE videos started going viral, like last summer. You started to see him lose support among independent voters. And people just, you know, I think they took that out from the immigration debate. And we're just asking, what is this guy doing? Like, this doesn't feel like it is on task and the reason we elected him. And that's why you see his support underwater on every issue among every single group except for Republicans, evangelical Christians, and Republicans.
Right. And you know what? Speaking of immigration, Annie, I wanted to get to you, but you're right, Peter. When I look at the trajectory in our own polling, the Cook Report is... For those who want us to log in to the Cook Political Report poll tracker, we are also tracking his support.
Subscribe.
You can get into the crosstabs. It's awesome. But yes, as we're looking at his support on immigration, it did. It like took a big dip in the summer. And I think that's exactly right, when the video started to really become part of the discourse. But Annie, you brought up a really good point, which is it was the one issue that he does feel strongest about. Is one issue that he campaigned very strongly on, where he was above water, really for much of his time as president in his first term. Now he's deeply underwater. And he did this rare thing, which is he saw things weren't going well in Minnesota and he turned down the temperature rather than turning it up. So does this mean he can actually do that pivot thing that we keep waiting for?
It was an interesting kind of confluence of events for Trump. You know, if you kind of go back, this is really important when you look at this president. I mean, he is a president who, you know, unlike sort of any other, at least in modern history, well, in the century, let's say, who is very much, it's like his personality embodies the presidency. Much of what his administration does comes directly from him. Not everything, but a lot of it really is coming, emanating directly from him. And this weekend, the weekend where this ICE raid happened, this is a weekend in Washington where it was snowing. And what does that mean? It means that Donald Trump was by himself, more or less, in the White House. And see, he was alone and consuming a lot of television. And so he was watching the images of this incredible moment where ICE agents shoot a man in the head, and watching it on replay over and over again, even including on his, you know, his favorite channel, Fox News, which played it repeatedly and also had commentators who picked apart some of the comments that Trump's own aides had used to sort of explain what happened. And the president is watching this very much in a vacuum, where he doesn't have aides coming in and distracting him or offering explanations for what happened. He's able to kind of just consume this in a way in which he was more alone than he normally is. Like, I'm not going to say that he was like entirely by himself the entire time, but it was a weekend in D.C. that was much more locked down than it typically is. And so that just put him in a different mindset. And I will say that when the president announced, and I believe it was Monday morning at like 8:30 a.m., that he was sending Tom Homan to Minnesota to take over the operation there, it caught a number of people in the White House orbit completely by surprise, in part because there wasn't this like buzz of activity in and out of the Oval Office or in and out of the residence like there normally would be when you don't have a snowstorm. So oddly enough, this like change to ICE really happened amid an actual ICE storm. And I'm being a little facetious there. I realize it was not ICE, it was Customs and Border Patrol. But you know, you do in this one with this beat, like unlike really, you know, the last two presidents, the last two Democratic presidents, getting into how Trump is feeling mentally and how he's processing information does really have a policy impact. So he made this change, and I really do think that was very much driven by the way he was consuming information. I will say with, you know, that the previous incident with ICE, where Ms. Good was killed, he also ended up processing some of that video just by happenstance with New York Times reporters who happened to have an interview with him that day and watched frame by frame with him as this sort of exchange unfolded, this deadly exchange unfolded. And so he just saw it in a different way. And I think, you know, unlike other presidents, you know, he is very much the sort of, because he embodies this administration and in its totality. So he made a decision about Minnesota and just executed it. And Tom Homan had been long seen as somebody who, I think Homan's sort of, people externally often view him as a really tough immigration guy, and he is. But he's within the administration not considered one of the hardliners. You know, Corey Lewandowski, Christine Noem, Stephen Miller are considered the kind of hardliner clique on immigration. And Homan has been outside of that, and that's the internal dynamics. So it was a signal to these hardliners within the administration that the president was going to make a change, and they have, by all accounts. I mean, they've taken officials out of there, and the president has tried to just move on from it. So, you know, I do think that has so far this year has been one of the most critical moments of his presidency, and has shown that he is willing to really change gears in the face of this kind of overwhelming evidence that what his administration is saying does not look true when you're watching the actual videos.
This is so fascinating because it also helps explain why this change in his attitude did not come with, oh, okay, now I'm going to fire Noem, or now I'm going to distance myself from Stephen Miller. He still believes in those folks, right? They are still empowered. So what are the odds that we're going to continue to see? It doesn't have to be as horrific and dramatic as what we saw in Minnesota with federal agents actually shooting someone, but continuing to see these ICE events where you are going to get videos of women being right thrown to the ground, yeah, or kids being separated from their parents. I mean, do we think they've also calculated that into the let's roll things slower roll a little bit?
Well, I mean, with Trump, you never want to make a bold prediction about, yeah, what he'll do writ large. And to your point, Stephen Miller is very much still an important part of the Trump, you know, inner circle. And, you know, that from there emanates Christine Noem and Corey Lewandowski and others who are part of kind of that hardline immigration kind of clique. But Trump has really dramatically shifted his language about this. He's saying that, like, now when cities are having issues, he wants them to ask, and to ask nicely. And he even said they need to say pretty please, I believe he certainly said please, that these cities, if they want the federal government to come in, they need to ask him and they need to say please. And that kind of puts us back to sort of the pre-Trump era of how federal intervention in local law enforcement, everything from, you know, riots to snowstorms, has always been that the locals will go to the federal government and ask. And so in many ways, you know, Trump has at least articulated a policy that kind of goes back to what the way things more typically have operated. Now, look, I don't want to sit here and predict how he's going to behave, you know, and what policy inputs he's going to be reacting to over the next 3 years. But in this moment, he has certainly massively calibrated the way he is handling these immigration raids. But I think he does realize that he has, you know, delivered to his voters on closing the border. And he has an enormous amount of credibility for doing that.
Right. Right. Peter, I want to take the other side of this coin here. You spent a lot of time covering campaigns and elections, and Democrats clearly think now that they have an advantage here, that they're going to be able to use this backlash about ICE to their benefit. One, they're using it legislatively. We may see a government shutdown as we speak here on Tuesday. There's still a chance that the government's going to get shut down because Democrats say, to Republicans, you haven't done enough. You haven't put enough restrictions on what on some ICE behavior in the funding bill. But Peter, there are also plenty of Democrats who worry that their party's going to overreach like they did in 2019 and 2020, and we're going to get into defunding ICE and defunding the police, and they're going to lose this advantage because of their own behaviors and certain calls within the party. So I'm curious if you think they are correct in their worrying about this, or whether they are kind of overthinking this.
Look, one, I think you're right. I think Democrats on Capitol Hill, even senators who don't like government shutdowns, you know, Jackie Rosen and Catherine Cortez Masto, Masto out here in Nevada, or sorry, out here on the West Coast where I am in Nevada, you know, they came out immediately after the Alex Pretty killing and were furious and saying we need to figure something out here. And it doesn't feel like a lot of that anger has gone away for Senate Democrats.
That's
and
right.
So I know, like, when for people like us, we talk about when will there be a government shutdown? Won't there be a government shutdown? The interesting thing to me was more, can they get something done in this 2-week window? Because
right.
It doesn't seem like they can. And John Fetterman, who's a gadfly, of course, but he went on Fox over the weekend and said, I think there's going to be a shutdown because Democrats have a list of 10 demands. And I don't think Republicans are going to budge on any of them. You have Republicans now saying they want to tie, you know, ICE reform to sanctuary city reform, or pulling funding for sanctuary cities, or punishing sanctuary cities. And, you know, we might have a partial shutdown, but it doesn't feel like anything can get done in the next 3-4 days. That seems a little nuts to me. I don't cover Capitol Hill every day, but that seems like a stretch. So maybe they pass another short-term extension. I did some work recently where a Democratic group gave me some polling that probably wasn't supposed to be public. It's from one of these, like, secretive Dem groups, the David Shore, you know, data people on the Democratic Party, who are, as you mentioned, I would say, like, lump them in with the popularism movement inside the Democratic Party, that you need to take positions on crime and public safety and immigration that are close to the median voter. Their thinking is that's how you win elections. And so Blue Rose Research did this poll that was funneled to me. And then basically what they did in the wake of Alex Pretty's killing was message test a bunch of Democratic messages, tweets, Instagram posts, you know, cable news clips that Democrats said after the killing. The stuff that performed best was Josh Shapiro's messaging in Pennsylvania, the governor, Rob Sand in Iowa, what is his position?
He's the auditor.
Auditor running for governor.
Yeah.
Nice guy, Rob. But he, you know, both of these Democrats put out messaging saying we need to reform ICE, but, like, not abolish ICE. That was the implication, that public safety is what matters. The stuff that didn't test well were messaging tweets like from Gavin Newsom, AOC, talking about oligarchy and fascism and blood in the streets. Like, people do not like ICE, we should say that, but they also care about public safety. They do think illegal immigrants who have committed crimes should be deported. And so I think Democrats are right to worry about this. They don't want it to become defund again. Abolish ICE was kind of lumped in with those that sort of radical chic vocabulary back in 2020. It was one of those things where moderate Democrats, establishment Democrats, centrists roll their eyes. This is, you know, DSA, Greenpoint, Brooklyn vernacular that doesn't play in the rest of the country. Abolish ICE has actually grown in popularity as a term, but it's interesting to see elected Democrats sort of modify it, saying things like abolish Trump's ICE.
A quick break and we'll be back with Annie Linsky and Peter Hamby. Did you know we have another podcast called Editor's Roundtable? That's right. Comes out once a week and features me and my colleagues pulling back the curtain to let you in on our insights on races, rating changes, polling, elections, everything else we'll be following and writing about this midterm year. You can find Editor's Roundtable on Apple Podcasts for just $1.99 a month, or become a paying subscriber to our new Cook Political Report Substack. Learn more about it in our show notes.
What I'm also hearing from some Democrats, and so we'll be curious to see you guys, what, if any, reconciliation happens on these two sides and whether we get a government shutdown over it, is Democratic base voters have become even more frustrated and entrenched on this idea of getting rid of ICE. And one Democratic strategist said to me, like, I just don't know that whatever Democrats are presenting right now is meeting the level of rage that Democratic voters have. And so that's when you get, right, that disconnect between what the party thinks is the right thing to do because we don't want to make the same mistakes, but missing out on where primary voters are, which if you're running in a competitive primary as a Democrat in a blue state, you don't have to worry about that. I was watching all the ads in the Illinois Senate primary right now are all anti-ICE. That's fine. It's Illinois. You don't have to worry about losing that Senate seat. But Michigan, Minnesota, right? Those are going to be very different.
The mayor of Minneapolis, which, you know, of all people might, you know, have space for a anti or a, you know, get rid of ICE message. Right. He's not saying that. He's saying reform ICE. So, right. you know, there are, you know, leaders in very liberal pockets that are using a more sort of moderate message, even in the face of two of his constituents being killed in raids that are immigration raids.
Yeah, I remember watching that one of the press conferences right after Alex Prater was killing. Mm. It was Jacob Frey, the mayor, and also Keith Ellison, who's just like, you know, true blue,
very liberal,
Attorney
very
General,
progressive. Yeah.
Former member of Congress. Both of them said, I don't know if they were asked, I couldn't hear the question, that, you know, ICE has a mandate. You know, ICE does have a role, but we need to fix what's going on here. And the way it's like that, the fact that those two weren't saying that. And also out here in California, by the way, another blue state with tons of primaries. You got a governor's race, you got a mayor's race here in LA, you've got a bunch of House races. You know, my thesis is like California is where the beating heart of the party is right now. Everyone needs to look at what's going on here because you do have your sort of abundance style centrist candidates running for governor, not centrist, but like, you know, not resistance-y. But then you have someone like Eric Swalwell, who's running for governor, the member of Congress, who is core resistance slop almost, who's like posting tweets about Don Lemon and, you know, Orange Man bad. He wants to get like strip ICE agents if they're revealed of their driver's licenses. And so like that is just like a pure play to, you know, just bomb throwing anti-Trump play to the base. They don't have to worry about winning a general election like Angie Craig or Peggy Flanagan would in Minnesota, and ICE is flaring in that primary. But the base is really mad. And by the way, like, you know, all due respect to my peer Eric Swalwell, I think we're like the same age, but like it feels kind of corny. It feels kind of performative to be like, we do a web video, we're going to strip ICE agents of their driver's licenses. But that probably plays out here, you know? You know, it, like Gavin Newsom's Prop 50 campaign in California was about redistricting, but all the TV ads were just about...
They were about Trump, right?
Trump, like, Trump, this is Trump, ICE, Trump. It was like, wasn't about congressional boundaries.
Absolutely not.
It works.
Yeah, it works until it doesn't. Annie, that's what I want to get at with you because you're covering the White House. Obviously, there are folks there who are also tasked with worrying about the midterms. Obviously, the president's not on the ballot, but his party is. What are they thinking and seeing? Like, are they seeing different data than we are, or they're saying the same numbers? And what do they think? How are they going to get through this?
It's a really good question. And I think there is a divide between what Trump thinks and what his close advisors think. And kind of getting back to my earlier point about how this kind of sort of presidency is really run by the one person with a, you know, click of people around him. You know, Trump and in the Wall Street Journal, and we had an interview with him. We asked him about this, and he said that he's worried about the midterms. He's articulated that. I was in Mar-a-Lago with him, not last weekend, but the weekend before, and I had a chance to ask him about the. It was right after the Texas legislative special election, where a seat that had Trump had won by 17 points went to a Democrat. And I was at Mar-a-Lago, like on this rope line, and I asked him about it. And his response was like, "Well, I won by 17 points. I did pretty well there." I mean, he's just kind of like focused the sort of answer to the question on the fact that he had done well there, and sort of ignored the part of the question where it was like, well, what does that say about how your party might be doing in a few months? You know, and his answer to that second less intriguing part of the question for him was like, well, you can't really know. It's hard to know what that really means. But I did great. I did great out there.
Right.
And I think that kind of in miniature does capture how he's looking at this. I mean, the Washington Post had a really good story that is on the front page today, but published yesterday. And it was about how there haven't really been decisions made about how to allocate this $300 million war chest that he is sitting on, that he has raised, and Republicans are desperately wanting to get out the door because, to you know, both of you are saying, this has been becoming a more and more difficult environment for Republicans, like, by the hour. So the president, you know, I tried to get him to talk about it in Mar-a-Lago, and, you know, his response was, I did great.
And that's the other thing, Annie, like, he does love to talk about a couple of things when it comes to midterms. One, he mentions a lot, and he's correct, that historically it's really hard for the party in power to pick up seats. They always lose seats. So he sort of talks about that a lot, right? This isn't about me. This is historic. I can't be at fault. The other, as you pointed out, is that, well, I did great there. It's, you know, nobody can compete with me because I'm great. And without me on the ballot, the party is really nothing. But the third thing is what has a lot of folks, certainly Democrats, worried. It's the idea that the president is going to try to, and his allies, do stuff after the election to cast doubt on it. Right? He's obviously talking about things like nationalizing the election, the FBI's in Fulton County, seizing voting materials. When you are talking to folks in the White House about this, what is their take about what we should be hearing from how the president is discussing this?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those, like, tricky conversations. The you know, the way that Caroline Leavitt, his spokeswoman, who is, I should say, a much more empowered spokeswoman than we are typically used to having with presidents. I think in some respects, even with Trump, I mean, she is in the room with Trump, you know, every single day. She's in a lot of the top meetings with him. So she's not... She is spinning, but she is also channeling, which we haven't really, you know, Biden's spokespeople weren't really doing that quite the same way. Obama was a different sort of situation, but she is really in the room with him. So she has a lot of access, and it always surprises me because she is just so young, and it is incredible. But, you know, her answer to this has been, look, what he means to say is he supports this SAVE Act, which is about making sure that there's an ID, that, you know, when you vote, every single person should have an ID. So she said, she points to this, his support essentially for voter ID. When you go to the voting polls, you have to show some sort of driver's license or passport or birth certificate. But, you know, I think that you're right that this idea of him continuing to, like, create this trail of breadcrumbs of doubt about an election, which looks, at least from the data right now, where we're sitting months away, not to be going in his direction, you know, is a fair thing to be alarmed about in terms of what he, where he might take that, given we've seen what he has done in the past when he lost the 2020 election. I do think it's sort of the bigger question does become what that sets up in terms of the presidential and how he might behave on, you know, in that scenario. Of course, he's not going to be on the ballot, so it's a very different scenario than it was in 2020. But these are kind of moments that are worth watching very carefully and chronicling very carefully because of how he has behaved in the past. And because even of all of the different norms that Trump has broken, you know, faith in elections is one that is, you know, it's just, you know, a particularly dangerous zone in a democracy where this is how we allocate power. And for him to start, you know, even now, putting the kernels of doubt on that is certainly something that we're keeping a close eye on.
I think we should be alarmed about him talking about the National Guard or ICE going into you know, different states and localities. He has already sent the National Guard into different cities over ICE protests. He sent the Marines out here to Los Angeles. They didn't do anything except hang out at the hotels, I think. But the SAVE Act is an important angle here that I think gets a little papered over, kind of. Trump in the White House last week, Andy, you might have been there, maybe it was a couple weeks ago, he, Caitlin at CNN, Caitlin Collins, maybe asked him about the nationalizing elections thing. And he kind of did the thing where he was like, well, I'm really talking about the SAVE Act, and Republicans need to pass the SAVE Act. And then he, like, I think he tossed to some senator, like Lindsey Graham, who's in the room with him, to, like, explain the SAVE Act. It's passed the House. John Thune, Leader Thune, has said they're just probably going to vote on it. It seems like it's going to pass. And the SAVE Act would require a passport to vote. Like, it's more than just voter ID, and plenty of states already have voter ID laws that passed, and this has been a GOP hobby horse even before Donald Trump. We all remember that. But you either need real ID showing citizenship, a passport, a military ID with proof of U.S. birth, a government-issued photo ID showing U.S. birth, or other issued photo ID with a birth certificate or naturalization documents. And so millions of people don't have these things. I mean, married women who change their last names, like, might be in trouble here when they show up to vote. I think the Brennan Center for Justice estimated some 20 million Americans don't have access to these documents. And the flip side is, if you look at public opinion, when you get into these details, by the way, you know, I'm sure you can find polls that slice it many different ways, but generally having a photo ID to vote is an overwhelmingly popular thing. So this will probably pass before the midterms. Again, I don't cover the ins and outs of Capitol Hill and how this legislation is moving, but it sounds like it's going to pass, and that could have a tremendous impact. And I would worry a little bit more about that, I think. And again, I, like, don't want to give Trump administration the benefit of the doubt on, you know, a show of force on election day. But, you know, especially with an election like this, I think with House elections, I don't know, Amy, you tell me, like, if you think this is like a wave year or not, but when those elections kind of happen, all of a sudden, seats you're not even thinking about are flipping out here in Arizona or over in Illinois or whatever, Ohio. Like, I didn't think that Ohio 11 was going to flip. And it's like, will Trump be questioning those elections and send the National Guard out to Akron, Ohio, like, ahead of time? Because, like, it feels like playing defense against a million different scenarios in a midterm election, whereas in a national election or the presidential, it's like you got six or seven or eight states where you could flex. I don't know.
I also do wonder, and the two of you would potentially know more than me, but on this SAVE Act, I have been wondering which coalition politically it impacts more.
Exactly. I mean, that seems really dangerous if you're a Republican coalition,
yeah,
which depends on a lot of people who probably don't have real ID.
Yeah.
Who probably don't have a passport, right?
Yeah, as the Democratic coalition becomes this sort of educated, more elite coalition,
exactly,
and they also have a very, you know, strong sense of, you know, a long tradition of getting their voters to the polls and a lot of apparatus to get their low propensity voters signed up, that I don't know exists right now on the Republican side with some of these voters who are particularly just Trump voters, the people who, you know, turned Pennsylvania, you know, red, and, you know, Trump has relied on so heavily. I have been really curious about whether this is, you know, I don't know who's really going to get hurt, whose coalition will be hurt. If you kind of put the just political brass tacks and put aside, like, disenfranchising voters for a minute.
That's a really good point, Amy. I saw you on PBS the other day, and you were talking about how Trump is actually shedding a little bit of support among white working class voters, white non-college voters. And do those people have passports? I mean, it's like, it's kind of like we sort of forget about this in our, like, political elite bubbles, but I think only like 40% of Americans even get on an airplane every year. So, like, think about the people that don't have IDs and the people who do. And Annie, you're right. Like, that's the college educated affluent Democratic coalition right there.
Plus, if you think about what it does do, though, you guys, it gets to where both of you have gone, which is it does create chaos, right? If you're at your polling place and the person behind the counter tells me that I don't have the right ID. I have not been verified. And then they say, well, you can fill out a provisional ballot though, right? Now we're gonna have all these thousands of provisional ballots and then questions about whether these people were actually able to vote. I mean, it sows some pretty serious doubt into the outcome of the election, which it seems like that's so much of what this conversation that Trump is bringing up is about, which is sowing doubt into the outcome, right? Which is, even if Democrats win, it wasn't fair. Even if we lose, it's because it was rigged. Or we lost because they didn't pass the Vote Save Act, right? We would have won with that. So either way, it insulates the president from blame.
And you can also imagine, to your point, if you have a larger than the normal amount of these provisional ballots, it impacting the outcome in more cases than we're used to. And quite frankly, Americans are used to knowing the outcome of the election pretty quickly. I mean, maybe not always a presidential election, and certainly not those California elections, Peter, which take forever. But I mean, it does, you know, when this draws out, when the outcome is unclear for days after days, that becomes difficult. I mean, it's of course all speculation. We don't know if it'll pass or if it'll pass in its current form, which I think, you know, Peter, some of the points that you've raised about it are ones that Republican lawmakers that I talk to in particular are, you know, share those worries. And the Republican lawmakers I've talked to about this see sort of this ultimately ending up as a voter ID law rather than having such strict provisions on it. But, you know, it's Capitol Hill, like, who knows? You know, I covered the other side of Pennsylvania Avenue.
It is, you guys, it's yet one more institution, the idea of the sanctity of voting that has lost its luster. Is interesting looking at, I was looking at some Pew polling the other day, and, you know, we shouldn't be surprised anymore by this, but it still always shocks me when Trump was in the White House, most Democrats didn't think there would be fair elections. When Biden was in the White House, Democrats thought there would be fair elections, and vice versa, right? So we are getting to a place now that no matter what happened, if you're the losing party, you now have been conditioned to believe that it was because the other side somehow rigged or cheated or, you know, made it harder for your side to vote.
There were Democratic, I think, senators who gave floor speeches after John Kerry lost Ohio in 2004, saying that they need to check the ballot boxes.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't Diebold then?
It was Diebold. Yeah. Wow.
I kept getting questions all deep into 2005, like, isn't it true that the Diebold machines were rigged and that's why John Kerry lost? But what's different was that Kerry et al. Pretty quickly, I mean, they said, that's right, like, we're not going down that road, right? We're just gonna, whatever happened, that's not where our attention going. Our attention is going to how we win the next election, not whether these machines were rigged. One final question for you, Peter, because I know that you, in your polling with your young men, young people, we're also asking them about 2028. And so I would love to get their early look. I mean, we always hear in our nice bubbles. I'm curious what young people think about it, whether they're paying any attention at all.
That's a larger question. And also, we should say a corollary to this whole conversation about Trump's popularity is that Democrats are not looked upon favorably either, both by all voters, but also young people in particular. I think Gallup a couple weeks ago released a survey about voters and their party affiliation, and unaffiliated registered at its like highest level ever among all voters. And it's really driven by Gen Z and millennials, and particularly Gen Z. And in NPR PBS Marist poll that they did recently, you know, the highest disapproval ratings for President Trump were among Gen Z. strong disapproval ratings. And so looking at 2028, Democrats have to, you know, litigate the primaries and find someone who can be a champion for them and feel like they can be trusted. Trust is the key word to deliver results. Like young people don't get to, you know, calm down, young people. You don't get to decide everything for the rest of us. Wait your turn. No, but they have to find someone that they really believe can help them get access to this economy. There are profound concerns about artificial intelligence disrupting, you know, both social norms, but more importantly, almost like economic jobs, the economy, et cetera, access to jobs and disruption. At the horse race we pulled with Generation Lab, again, that's just college students. So if you think about college Dems, AOC is up there. You know, that checks out a little bit. She's not as high if you do it among all young people. If you do it among all young people, because this is not just a swingy group of voters, young men, I mean, it's a hard to reach group, young men and young women. And so they aren't, you know, we call them low information or low propensity voters. It's like they aren't following the stuff day in and day out. And so Kamala Harris has pretty high name ID.
Yeah, because they remember her name, right?
Like, of course, that's it. I mean, I don't think she runs again. Gavin Newsom is up there. He's famous. And people forget about Newsom. Like, he's been trolling Trump and very successful playing the media game over the last year, doing Prop 50, fighting Donald Trump. But he's been famous for a very long time. So he's up there as well. After Pete Buttigieg, after AOC, it just really falls off for Democratic voters, young voters, and all voters. I mean, look at any poll. It's a wide open field. Shapiro, Booker, Gallego, like, people don't know who any of these folks are. Gavin Newsom's in the driver's seat right now. The question for him is, like, is it too early to be peaking? You know, we'll see. I want to wait at least until after the midterms to start doing my stupid presidential punditry. But, and then on the Republican side, it's J.D. Vance and everybody else. But he's not popular among young people either. Like, just because he's associated with Donald Trump, who's slightly more popular with young people, J.D. Vance is not very well-liked among young people. And even young Republicans on college campuses don't have a strong, favorable opinion of him.
Which is really, really interesting.
Yeah, because he fashions himself as, like, this generational bridge. And he thinks about, you know, tech and populism. He just, like, brings together this, like, new sort of Republican ideology. And if you survey college Republicans, they don't like him at all, actually. He's underwater with them right now. But that's just symptomatic of the Republican Party in general at this point also.
You guys, this has been so fantastic. I so appreciate you taking time out of your day to talk with me about this and keep our listeners even smarter than they already are. Hopefully you are going to have a great day because you deserve it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be with you, Amy. Appreciate it.
Yeah, this was awesome. Thanks.
Thank you so much for listening to The Odd Years. If you liked what you heard or want to make a suggestion, leave us a review. Or better yet, recommend us to a friend. You are our best way to get the word out about what we do. And if you want more from the Cook Political Report, consider becoming a subscriber. Go to cookpolitical.com/subscribe. Listeners can use the discount code ODD10, that's ODD, the number 10, to save 10% on any subscription. This offer is available only to new subscribers. The Odd Years is brought to you by the Cook Political Report and is produced by Becca Kaufman.